We'll hear argument now in three consolidated cases, United States against Sawyer, United States against Duncan, and United States against Rogers. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. And I represent the appellants in this case, Mr. Michael Sawyer, Mr. Patrick Duncan, and Mr. Terrell Rogers. The judges in each of these cases ordered restitution and ordered that it be due and payable immediately instead of establishing a repayment schedule, particularly in two cases for while the defendants were in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. The question in this case is whether there is error, and if so, whether that error is plain. One of the government's arguments in these cases is that the district court's ordering restitution due immediately should be sufficient in and of itself. And before this court's opinion in Day, that would have been true. However, as this court ordered in Day, this court changed that particular reading of due and payable immediately based on a very careful reading of the Mandatory Victims and Restitution Act. This court's reiterated the court's holding in Day and more recently Thigpen, where it said explicitly, this court in Day explicitly opposed the district court's attempt to minimize its responsibility to set a restitution schedule by ordering immediate payment. As a result, that argument should be rejected by this court. The government's main argument in all of these cases, however, is that this is not plain error. The government argues that the third and fourth prongs of plain error review are not met by this particular error and relies on this court's opinion in Tejada.
Forget about Tejada. I'm just interested in how it could be plain error on a straightforward understanding of Olano or anything else. The restitution obligation is money your client owes. How is it plain error for the court to say, pay the money you owe? Right? Since your client concededly owes the money, statement, pay the money you owe, doesn't sound like a miscarriage of justice.
Well, Your Honor, of course the court can and must say, pay the restitution you owe. However, in addition, the court, by statute, is supposed to order the repayment schedule. Without that order, of course, the defendants don't necessarily know how much they're going to have to pay, obviously.
They have to pay it all, right? They owe it all now, right? The further overlay of a problem on this is that if the defendant doesn't have the money, then the repayment schedule doesn't matter. You can't get blood from a stone. Right. If the judge says pay it all instantly and the defendant doesn't have it, he's not going to pay it instantly. If, on the other hand, he does have it, then it's very difficult to see how the lack of a schedule is injurious because you don't have to set a schedule that allows somebody who can pay not to pay it.
And, of course, that's a distinction the court made in Day versus McIntosh.
Yeah, but all of which just seems to say it's harmless. I mean, just not harmless. Contrast this with a civil case. Right? We keep saying restitution is just the collection through the criminal process of a civil debt. If you steal money from somebody else, you have to pay it back. If this were a civil case, the judgment would say, pay X now. There'd be no schedule in a civil case. Right?
Civil case, of course, but there's no statutory obligation of the judge to order this. I'm talking about the process here more than anything, I think. The process in this kind of situation is the defendant's supposed to know how much it's supposed to repay, not necessarily because he can.
Now.
Not necessarily because he can, but because there is a right to appeal if the district court was incorrect in the amounts. Based on the evidence that the court's supposed to review of the person's ability to pay. Now, in these cases, the reason that we're before here, of course, is these defendants are indigent. They, at the moment, probably don't have the wherewithal to repay most of the restitution, although one person has restitution in the amount of $1,800. Of course, over 20 years, that person probably can repay that, more or less.
Well, why don't you speak to that issue of relief, how they could get relief if the Bureau of Prisons set that amount versus the district court?
Well, the Bureau of Prisons has a default program for people who don't have an order imposing how much to repay. And their default is 50% of how much they make. And if you participate in that, you're allowed better jobs for the most part, although that's you're not necessarily going to get better jobs simply because you're participating in it. But one of the problems, and the government's pointed this out, is because we don't know what the district court would have ordered, because the district court didn't order, we don't know, we can't prove that the district court's order would have been beneficial to the defendants as compared to this default program. However, in at least two...
All of which just sounds like you're making the prosecutor's case. If you don't know what the district court would do, and you don't know whether it's erroneous, it sounds like a reason to go to the district court, ask the district court to set a schedule, and appeal if you think the district court made a mistake. It doesn't sound like an argument for plain error.
Your Honor, I have to concede that point, but I was going to point out that at least two of the cases, the district court did impose a repayment schedule for when the defendants were going to be on supervised release.
Yes, those schedules appear to me to be plain error. Plain error in favor of the defendant, because they look like schedules that excuse nonpayment. One of the schedules doesn't even cover the interest on the debt. Right? And the statute is perfectly clear that the judge can't excuse nonpayment, and setting an unrealistically low schedule is the equivalent of excusing failure to pay.
Your Honor, I disagree respectfully.
You disagree with what? Do you think the schedules will call for payment? How do you think a schedule that does not cover interest on the debt calls for payment of that debt?
Your Honor, I believe that
if those payments are made from now until the sun swallows the earth in 5 billion years, the debt will not be repaid.
Well, they wouldn't be repaid in most cases, in cases where I represent people, in any event, whether there is interest or not.
That's a different problem. The statute says the judge cannot excuse nonpayment. And therefore, it seems to me that a schedule that, if followed, will not retire the debt is the same thing as nonpayment of the debt.
Your Honor,
there may be plain error here, but it favors your clients.
I respectfully disagree that there's plain error in the district court's rulings. Now, of course, my clients are subject to revocation of supervised release if they're not making good faith payments based on this schedule or any other schedule that the court imposes while they're on supervised release. That's really the hammer that district courts have over indigent clients while they're on supervised release. That's the only hammer they'll ever have, whether there's a repayment schedule that's got interest or not.
Is the difference if the BOP sets the schedule, it's during their incarceration, and that they can enforce it with certain penalties?
Because of course, the Bureau of Prisons can enforce it. They have direct control to the commissary account.
Right. Right. So, but a court order wouldn't accomplish that, would it?
I believe a court order would. It's what's one of the things the Bureau of Prisons is supposed to take into account when they determine how much to repay.
So they do it anyway, even with a
court
order?
They're the ones who are going to supervise it. They have a direct control to the commissary whether or not the district court actually imposes a schedule. That the Bureau of Prisons has a default provision that.
So if someone, say, doesn't comply, let's say we've got a court order, sets out the schedule given to the Bureau of Prisons. Bureau of Prisons decides, no, you have to pay more. Let's say the district court sets a schedule that's less than this 50% default. What can the inmate do to appeal? Can the inmate come back to the district court?
No, I don't believe so.
Because when we're trying to figure out what the error, what the harm is, you know, if you're in a situation like in the drug testing situation or being in a drug rehab situation, even if you're in the Bureau of Prisons, you know, arguably, and I think defendants do come back to the court because the court initially entered the order and they can get some relief. Is that right?
You know, I'm afraid I'm not fully familiar with what relief prisoners in the Bureau of Prisons can get if the Bureau of Prisons doesn't follow a district court's order.
Right, but we're talking about the error here, though, it seems to me the answer to that question would have some bearing on it, isn't it? I thought it was in the province of the Bureau of Prisons, and you know what they said basically goes what the court is making. It is an order, but it's a recommendation. Essentially, that's how it's treated by the Bureau of Prisons. Yeah. So you don't have any right to appeal.
Well, not in this court. I believe in the Bureau of Prisons you'd be able to argue that the district court...
Right, but that's what I'm talking about, the district court. I'm talking about the district court, no rights in the district court. So when we're trying to weigh the harm, you know, you've got an administrative remedy at the Bureau of Prisons because you can say, look, this is problematic, and at least an inmate can petition.
But I think you'd only have that kind of remedy if there was a court order putting a schedule and the Bureau of Prisons determined that that was not correct.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. How can you get relief? And, you know, trying to draw a distinction.
I think if the Bureau of Prisons doesn't have a court order establishing a repayment schedule, they're going to abuse the default procedures.
Could you speak up, please?
I believe that the Bureau of Prisons will use their default procedures.
What does that mean?
I mean, I've outlined it in the brief. It's 50% if you're in a unicorn position. It's $25 for a particular period of time if you're not, or depending on your resources. Now, that includes people sending money into their family members.
Does the Bureau of Prisons have a regulation that covers this?
Yes, they do. I believe it's also in 28 CFR 545.11D, but it's program statement 5380.08, and I've cited that in...
Could you read that out again, please?
Sure, excuse me. Bureau of Prisons program statement number 5380.08.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I don't know if I've answered your question.
And that regulation says?
That regulation covers the Bureau of Prisons Financial Inmate Responsibility Program, including what it does to set the program up, how it's implemented, and it's really all I know about it.
But nothing there about any rights that an inmate might have.
Not appeal rights. I don't believe it says that.
All right.
The other point that I wanted to make, Your Honors, is that, of course, the money, that the commissary money, can be used for many things, but it's also an inmate's only ability to access the outside world. The Bureau of Prisons is the quintessential company store. Inmates have to purchase telephone minutes, writing utensils, paper, envelopes, stamps, everything that it would require to contact their lawyers and or family members. Unless there are any other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. McGowan.
Thank you.
Mr. Chang.
May it please the Court, Edmund Chang for the United States. What the defendants want here is for the district judges to set a nominal payment schedule. And the defendants cannot meet their burden to show the third and fourth elements of the plain error test. And Tejada undermines all the cases to the contrary.
If you calculate the present value of the payment streams that the district court set for in the two cases where schedules were set for after prison, what is that present value?
The problem is we don't know because the schedule is 10% of the net monthly income that the defendants would make on supervised release. We don't know what their monthly income will be on supervised release. That's why we're not here.
I thought the judge set money amounts or, in the alternative, some other amount.
I don't believe, Your Honor, in Rogers and Sawyer, which are the two cases from the Northern District of Illinois, that the judge said, the judge set a specific restitution total and then did not set a schedule for when the defendants were incarcerated. What the judges did say is when you're on supervised release, we'll take 10% of your net monthly income. Okay, so we don't know what the net monthly income is.
Well, the Rogers has 1,800, so that's not a problem. But one has 1,886. That might be a problem.
Right, and we may very well, when the defendant, it's Michael Sawyer, who has the restitution judgment that's in excess of $1 million. You know, we may very well, if we think he's not paying enough at that time, seek a modification of the restitution order. But we're not going to, because we can't show now that it's plain error. We're not here asking for that. And that, I think that the flip side is...
The maximum period over which a schedule can run is 10 years, I believe.
It's actually, it may be even less because it's supervised release, and if right. supervised...
Well, if you were going to collect a $1 million restitution judgment over a period of 10 years, how much has to be paid per year?
$100,000.
No. It has to collect it with interest, right? This is just an amortization problem. Have you run the calculation?
I have not run the calculation.
Okay, well, we'll do it.
I think this points out, though, why the defendants can't show that they are prejudiced by the lack of a payment schedule. They are indigent, and the only thing that they can point to is that there's this IFRP, the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program, that is run by the Bureau of Prisons. But that's an infirm basis for prejudice for two reasons. The first is that program is voluntary. It's true. They lose certain privileges if they do not participate, but they can refuse to participate. And those privileges are not required by the Constitution, by any statute, or by regulation.
So, in other words, if they choose not to participate in the 50% default, they have that option? Is that what you're saying?
They do. They would lose those privileges.
And they would lose the privileges.
They would lose the privileges, but they're not. But none of those privileges are legally required by any authority. Now, if I could try to explain how the BOP regulation works and the policy statement that the Bureau of Prisons has issued on this matter. There is a $25 minimum per quarter payment schedule that the BOP sets up for those inmates who are either not in Unicor, which is that the prison-run corporation, or they're in grade 5 of Unicor. If they are in grades 1 through 4 of Unicor, then the monthly payment is a minimum of 50% per month. Okay, that's if there is no payment schedule. Now, and what can they appeal that if they don't like what their prison counselor has set? They do have administrative remedies internally. The first step is to try to work it out with the warden, and this is covered by regulations at 28 CFR 542.10. And if they don't like what the warden said, then they can go to the regional director of the BOP. And if they don't like what the regional director said, they can go to the general counsel of the BOP. So that's internal. Now, what about going back to the district court? Well, there is a provision, 18 U.S.C. 3664K, which we cited in our briefs, which says that if the defendant's economic circumstances have changed, you can go back to the district court. And you know, we submit that if the Bureau of Prisons is assessing this liability on the inmate's account, that the defendants could go back and ask for relief. Now, the relief, to be very clear on this, is not judge direct the BOP to take only X number of dollars. The judge, we don't believe the judge has any statutory authority to do that. But what the judge could do is set a payment schedule. If what the problem is the lack of a payment schedule. Okay? But we don't know, and that's this is why this is not plain error. We don't know whether the district judge had the respective judges set a payment schedule. It would have been better or worse than what BOP has applied. I think standing here right now, I don't even know if these defendants are in the IFRP. We don't know whether they're participating or if they decided to refuse. The other thing I want to point out is that if the district court were to enter an order changing the payment schedule, it is the Bureau of Prisons policy, and this is in that policy statement that the defendant's counsel cited here in his brief. On page 7, it says, if the JNC has a specific payment plan outlined, payments are to be collected according to the direction provided in the order. Okay, so as a matter of policy, not by regulation and not by statute, but as a matter of policy, the Bureau of Prisons has taken it upon itself to honor a court order changing the payment schedule while in prison. So this is readily correctable if it's even a problem, if the lack of a schedule is even a problem. It's readily correctable by the defendant in filing a motion with the district judge. Okay, so
I'm trying to track down citations on the fly. Where's this language that you've most recently cited? Because I've got 545.11 I'm staring at it, and I can't find what you just said.
It's not in there, Your Honor. It's in the policy statement issued by the Bureau of Prisons. I'll give you the citation, and it is on the BOP website. It's P5380.08, and the specific page I was reading from was page 7. The BOP's website has publications and policies.
Just so long as I know that that's in the program statement, but not in the regulation.
That is correct.
Thank you.
So because this problem, if it is a problem, is so readily fixable, I think that is a reason why not only the defendant cannot show prejudice under the third requirement of plain error, but they also can't show that the lack of a schedule impugns the fairness and the integrity of the proceedings below. And that's, of course, the fourth element, that if it does impugn the fairness of the proceedings, then this court can exercise discretion under Olano and Rule 52 to correct the error. But as has been pointed out before, the lack of a payment schedule doesn't impugn the fairness of proceedings. First, it's true that in civil debts, for example, there is never a payment schedule, and it's just up to the creditor to collect using whatever collection procedures are available. So this happens all the time with civil judgments. So I don't think it impugns the integrity of these proceedings for there not to be a payment schedule. Again, it's so readily fixable that we think an appeal in a situation like this would do more to impugn the reputation of judicial proceedings than trying to fix this. And I'd also like to point out another piece of evidence that I think tends to undermine that we have to worry about the integrity of the judicial proceedings. You may know that the Judicial Conference has proposed legislation to Congress and earlier this year in which the Judicial Conference is asking Congress to get rid of the requirement to set a payment schedule and leave it up to the financial litigation units of the U.S. Attorney's offices, leave it up to the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program to collect.
By the way, I just searched for the statement 5380.08 on the Bureau of Prisons website. It's available only in Spanish.
Your Honor, I've been to that website and I've seen it, and it's definitely not just in Spanish.
No, their Bureau of Prisons search engine thinks that only a Spanish version can be found.
Okay.
I will eventually track it down.
I'd be happy to submit a copy.
I'm sure we'll find it.
Okay. The non-Spanish version, hopefully.
Right.
And so where the Judicial Conference itself is proposing to get rid of this requirement that district courts micromanage payment schedules, I don't see how that impugns the integrity of the proceedings when there isn't a schedule set. Now let me just say this last thing, and I don't want this to be, if I may run into my colleague's time here, and this isn't a criticism of the Defendant's Counsel, who I think was, of course, following the current state of the law in this circuit. These are the sole issues in these appeals. All right? So the inference that I draw from that is that there's no other non-frivolous merit issues, and that what would have happened otherwise is there would have been an Anders brief, and the defendants would have gotten a chance to respond and file a Circuit Rule 51 statement if they wanted to. But that hasn't happened here, and this is the sole issue that's been presented. There isn't any other, review of the record that this court's going to make. We think that it's time to put this reversible plain error doctrine to bed, as Tejeda did in the drug testing context, and we ask you to do that for restitution payment schedules. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chang. Ms. Garrison.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Judge Easterbrook, if inmate Patrick Duncan was here, I'm certain he could cite all of the program statements to you in chapter and verse. He had 18 criminal history points and was on federal supervised release at the time of the instant offense. What is extraordinarily frustrating is to the extent that the defendant argues that there was a grave constitutional moment at sentencing, why isn't it raised at sentencing? It was not going to be any surprise that there was going to be mandatory restitution imposed in the case. In Duncan, Your Honors, Judge Reagan ordered restitution in an amount just over $177,000. He ordered that it be paid in full immediately. He then questioned on the record whether this defendant would ever be able to pay that amount of restitution during his lifetime. He then made participation in the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program optional, stating that payments may be made through that program. At no point did he require this defendant to participate in the IFRP.
I don't see how he either could or couldn't.
There have been instances where sentencing judges have ordered expressly that payments shall be made through the program, but
is that within the court's power? Any more than the court could say, I order the Bureau of Prisons to give him a bed with the following linen?
Well, I think
district judges don't run the Bureau of Prisons.
Well, he could order, Your Honor, that payments shall be made during the term of imprisonment. The way that is most customarily done is through...
Yes, he can make an order binding in personam on the defendant. He can't make an order binding in personam on the Bureau of Prisons.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree. He can order the defendant to participate in the program to the extent to which that's enforceable. It's not. Now, this judge, Your Honor, did...
But aren't most of the orders are the court would say you shall participate and payments should be made through the Bureau of Prisons. And that's really from an administrative standpoint, so it doesn't get shunted off to the probation office to try to collect while they're in the prison.
Right? I agree.
It's just the methodology of the payment.
That it's a matter of administrative convenience,
right,
that there is this mechanism. You don't send the payment to the clerk. You can pay through the program.
Right.
He certainly did not require the defendant to do so. And insofar as the term of supervised release is concerned, the sentencing judge anticipated that there would be a balance remaining, and he provided that payments shall be made in the amount of $100 per month during supervision or 10% of net monthly income.
Yeah, that's what I thought. If you amortize $100 per month for the defendant's expected lifetime, what does it come to?
He's not going to be able to pay it.
But you haven't done the exercise either, nor have you done the exercise of figuring out what he would have to pay per month in order to retire the debt.
It hadn't occurred to me, but I think that Your Honor does demonstrate that
the statute says that the judge cannot excuse payment, and setting a payment schedule too low to repay the debt is just a form of excusing payment. So one might think that just as the defendant's lawyer would be saying, please set a low schedule, the prosecutor would have calculated the schedule high enough to actually pay the debt and inform the judge about it. Because otherwise, the judge is violating the statute.
I believe that does demonstrate the point that Your Honor made earlier, that the defendant cannot meet his burden of showing plain error, and to the extent that we...
But I'm just shocked that neither side has figured out what kind of schedule the judge has to set in order to comply with the statute. And here we are on appeal.
Well, I think it was implicit at the time that the order was imposed that it's not going to be paid. This is a defendant who has...
The judge is forbidden by the statute from setting an order too low to require full payment. All right, the statute, this was the whole point of the mandatory amendment to the statute. Judges have been setting schedules that did not require full payment, and Congress said that must stop. The judge must require full payment. And acquiescence in a schedule too low to be full payment is simply not in compliance with law.
Then the error is in defendant's benefit, and perhaps he should withdraw his appeal. Nothing further. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. McGowan, anything further?
Unless the court has any questions, no. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I hope we can one way or another, bring an end to this string of appeals on this question. The cases are taken under advisement.